72. This is an interview, and this is Betty Ann Gibbs, who lives at Port Aransas on Mustang Island.
Well, we came down here in 1937, in June, to build this tourist camp. We started on one cottage, and Mr. Gibbs stayed over here and worked on it, and I stayed in a motel over in Aransas Pass. We built the one, and we'd spend the weekends on the beach sometimes, just sleeping and eating down there, and then I'd go back to the motel, and he'd go on with the building. The first year we were here, we built two cottages, and then I went back to Oklahoma City and taught school another year. Then the next year, we built two more and rented the other two. And from then on, our time has been taking up the camp and adding to it as the years have gone by. We've never gotten in debt on the thing. We've always paid it as we've gone along. Then in 1942, we had one bad storm. And that was a storm that we decided we would not carry any storm insurance anymore, because we'd been carrying this insurance for since 37, 5 years. And we got $17.50 out of the insurance company. So we decided it would be safer for us to put our money in the bank and pay our own insurance, which we did. Then in 1940, our daughter was born. Things began to get a little more complicated, and the war came along, and during the war, the island was almost isolated. We had to have, anyone that went fishing had to have Coast Guard identification. And the fishermen, of course, were going to be pretty hard up about this, because it was very difficult to get this identification. But my husband took identification pictures for any fisherman that came, and we'd sit up all night getting them ready so they could have them at 5 o'clock in the morning and go fishing. And this helped the island people out, and ourselves, of course, too. And there were several instances when we had dusk to dawn blackouts, really. And we had to keep our radios covered with blankets if we had them on at all. And it seemed rather foolish to us, because the big silver tanks over on Harbor Island shone like moons, of course. But we did this to everyone cooperated. And on the island at that time, during this time, we had Navy and Coast Guard and a dog patrol, and also a field artillery unit, coastal artillery unit is what it was. And the big guns, we'd hear them every so often, but mostly they were practice shots. But there were occasions when they really had to use them.
I heard that there was a submarine that was sunk off, a German submarine.
Yes, it was about, I don't know how far out. They said about 25 miles out. It was trying to get into our channel, they thought. Because this was a strategic thing. If they could block this channel out here, then the big ship, our tankers, couldn't get in or out, and they'd have trouble getting the oil shipped up the East Coast, where most of the ships went from here, got sunk up there. That was funny. But we have a sign downstairs in the office that came off of this German submarine. Mr. Gibbs found it on the beach quite a ways down. Oh, I guess a year, maybe 2 years after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells when the wash days are in German. They can wash on certain days at certain times. But we then rented the cottages during this time to service personnel. We had two or three ensigns here, and lieutenant commander, and the doctors. And they bring their families down. And we've heard later that actually this place was mostly the doomsday brigade down here with the coastal artillery. Any boys up on the East Coast that were too bad, too hungry, they send them down here to this godforsaken place. It really wasn't that bad, but there, of course, at that time there was only the one grocery store, and the truck would come over I guess it came three times a week on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays to bring fresh vegetables and milk and things. And we had got to the place where we had to go down and stand in line because the young girls that married these soldiers would come down and they had nothing to do but go wait on it, and they'd go grab them off of the bus, off the truck even. So the island people had to stand in line and get the poor old groceryman to hold them for us so we could have something to eat.
Did y'all have very much trouble getting enough?
Oh no, there was plenty available. Of course we were on food stamps, on stamps for sugar and shoes and stuff like that, like everybody else. Our main problem was transportation to Corpus or to any place from here, because the gas, of course, was the main thing, and then they required so much identification to get on the island and get off. And they were watching the pipeline, which is the oil pipeline coming out from there. That was needed, and they didn't dare let anybody on the causeway at the other end that might blow it up. It was kind of rough. And several times we took what was called a Q-boat. It was an army boat that they had down here that went into Corpus. Oh, I think twice or three times a week. I remember we went once on Tuesday. So it must have gone on Tuesdays and Saturdays or something. And only army or service personnel was supposed to go on it, but occasionally they let some of the rest of us go. And I remember we went once. And you could we'd get over there about 11 o'clock, and then it would start home again about 2. So really wasn't much that you could do in that short length of time. But we were almost glad to get any excuse to get off the island there.
Well, did y'all have any other skiers down here besides the submarine saboteurs or anything?
Well, we don't know. This was always very hush-hush, but there were reports of submarines in the Gulf, and the planes would fly over from the Naval Air Station, and we'd hear the thuds of, bombs, I guess, or whatever. And then most of the boats that were stationed here that went out had those depth charges on them. They'd go out it. And we'd hear the sirens going off down the beach ways. So we never did know for sure, but they said one time that four Germans had gotten on the beach on the submarine. But whether this was true or not, I don't really know. You can hear almost anything in that kind of yeah. But it was exciting and interesting, and we were all glad when it was over, though. And I was particularly glad when the picture taking was over. And my husband got so disgusted with it during all that, having to do it so much, that he just gave away his cameras when it was over. Hasn't made very many pictures since, because that was a real job. Well, our son was born then in 1944. And that was quite an experience. The ferries were running only during the daylight hours, and they'd stop at 8:30 at night and not start again till 6 in the morning. So of course I needed to get to the hospital at 9 o'clock one night, and it was in the last of January when the weather's really pretty weird, and we had been told that some of our friends that had moved over on the mainland, one woman in particular had given up her camp to the service people. She said, "Oh, Miss Gibbs, any time you need to go, you just let me know. I'll save gas and we'll be all right. I'll come out day or night." And then we had some boatman friends who always said, "Oh, don't worry about getting across the channel. We'll get you across the channel if Mrs. Dean will meet you on the other side." So this was all well and good. But of course, the night that things needed to be done, she didn't have any gas, and it was dreary and rainy and blowy, and the men who were supposed to have their boats ready to go either didn't have any gas, or they were sick in bed with the flu or something. So we called the Coast Guard, which we always have always felt that you could depend on the Coast Guard. but we don't anymore. Because he wouldn't even take us across. And so Mr. Gibson, I walked down to the where our little skiff was tied up, waded out to the boat, and he rowed me across the channel, and we called a taxi in the meantime. Had tried to get a taxi and couldn't get the taxi, so we called an ambulance, and Mr. Marshall said, well, if you don't need an ambulance, I'll have somebody there. You just get across the channel. So we made it by rowing across and saw the taxi sitting up there. Turned on his light, so we assumed he'd seen us and was going to wait on us. But instead, he had decided that some drunk had called or something. It was just a hoax. So he was getting ready to leave when I walked up the side of the car. We made it all right, of course.
Well, when you first came to the island, what did you think of it? You're from Oklahoma, and it must have been quite a change.
Well, it was a very great change, because I was always used to trees and greenery and busyness and everything. But at that time, the island was, there were no tourist camps in this area at all, but over closer down to the waterfront, there was one camp that had about 5 units, I think, and then they did have running water, but no heat, and the shower, the commode and the shower were built on this building with a flat floor so that the water just out of the shower just fell on the ground, of course. And it was very primitive. And then Mrs. Dean's cottages were the only real nice ones, and they were the stucco ones up on the sand dunes, I think. They were nice. But then there was, and Mrs. Felton's cottages were here, but they were very sort of primitive. Nothing was built up like it is now. It was only one paved street, and it wasn't very well paved. And the ferry landing was right down in the middle of the heart of town in front of the hotel. And the ferries, there was only one, no, I guess there were two ferries even then. The Estelle and the Nellie B. They were named after the wives of the owners of the causeway. And one of them was an all wooden ferry, and I don't know how old she was then, because I think my brother came over on her in the early 1920s. Hmm. When they had the only way they could get out then was to come out on the railroad all the way to the ferry landing, and then they changed there to the ferry to come across. And the little old trolley, let's see, what did they call it? I can't remember the name of that little train that they brought out here. They put the cars up on the flat cars. It was pulled by this funny little train, and it came all the way out. We always thought one of the signs was so funny when they built the road, and it followed the railroad track, and places on the 7 bridges out here, that you had to take turns with the train or with other people. There were turnouts on them. But at the beginning of the first bridges, there was a big, big sign that says, straddle the rail and keep astride. We thought that was real funny. But the first 2 or 3 years we were here, or maybe more than that, people would come out and have a good time and get drunk and then try to drive that railroad back to town. And several times they'd run off and cars would land on the pipes on the side. I don't remember anybody getting killed, but the cars were certainly badly damaged. Then, let's see, the beach was beautiful then. The beach was simply magnificent. It was always, everyone enjoyed it that came. It was very private at that time, of course. And we've always felt like it. The worst thing that ever happened to the island was when they took the ferry fare off, because now it's bedlam down there. You can't enjoy it at all anymore. We found many bottles, beautiful bottles, and lots of shells and wood, particularly, that Michigan has made into furniture. This table and all of these things are made out of driftwood off the beach. And then I started, when Ann was six, I started teaching school again, with taking her back and forth to Aransas Pass. The school out here at that time was just a four-room school, and they were teaching 12 grades in the four rooms with four teachers. And I don't think there were, there might have been 50 students in it, all 12 grades. But I felt like I wanted her to have more competition than that. So they needed teachers in Aransas Pass, so I went back to teaching. And she had to ride the merchant seaman bus, because we didn't have a car at that time. The bus came out on the even hours and went back on the odd hours from Aransas Pass. It was a little jitney type bus. But the merchant seamen rode it. They got off of the tankers out here, and they would go into town, and then late in the evening or whenever their ship was due to sail, they would get back on and come on out. And we felt like she was a little young to have to compete with adults, that type of an adult on this bus. So that was the main reason I started teaching, going back to it. And at that time, in Aransas Pass, they had the high school, but the only grade school was at that time it was called Central Ward. It's a two-story building. Well, it's really three, the basement, but it was only used for restrooms. And two-story building. We taught eight grades there. And then they had the junior high and high school in what's now the high school building in Walter Noble. Walter Noble School was built then, too. So I started in the third grade. We had, I believe we had three third grades at that time. And now we have six of every section. But then in a short time, in I guess less than 5 years, they built what now is a Keyburger School. And then we moved first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth there. Then they kept the seventh and eighth at what's now called, it was Central Ward, is now May Allen. And then they moved the high school on at 9, 10, 11, and 12 up, stayed where it was.
Well, y'all weren't paid very much back then, were you?
Well, no, but better than I was in Oklahoma. I think I started down here at about $1,200 a year. But in Oklahoma, the first years that I taught, this was in 1933 and 34, around in there, I got $810 for the year, and you paid to have your job. But you were lucky to have any kind of a job then. I've thought so often about that $810 went a whole lot farther than the salaries nowadays, even, I do believe, because I paid board and room, and I went back and forth home often, and helped my brothers both through college and saved money.
No, I don't believe that.
I did. And I made it. I spent one summer in California going to the University of Southern California, and I had to save that much money to do that.
Mm.
I don't know how, but money went farther, I guess. I don't know what it was. Anyway. But the schools in Oklahoma were good schools at that time, even though the pay was little. I felt that they were much more progressive than the Texas schools. But now they've fallen back a whole lot in Oklahoma. They're having problems, financial and otherwise, it seems, where I think the Texas schools are increasing in enrollment and having better qualified teachers, too. And I think, of course, the salaries are much better than they are in the eastern part of the United States. I was visiting over there last summer with my daughter, and those teachers in South Carolina and Mississippi are poorly paid. Oh, terrible.
Well, what would you say was the greatest change, say, from the time, the first year you taught to this year in education?
Well, let's see. The greatest change. Equipment, yes, much more equipment. And I frankly think the children themselves are much brighter than children we had. I think these modern children are much brighter. I'm teaching fourth grade now, and I think that these fourth graders are, I would say, almost equal to the sixth graders that we had when we first started.
Hmm.
Whether this is due to good nutrition or the more equipment that we have, or the TV, I frankly think the TV has a great deal to do with it. I think it's created a great deal of interest in things, and children see and hear more. So I feel like that probably is the biggest growth for education that we have, is the TV.
Not many people would agree with you on that. A lot of people think TV is one of the worst things that has ever happened.
Well, no, it has its liabilities, so I'll have to admit that, but mercy sake, we used to have to go to the picture show to see a picture, and now the children can just turn on the TV and see things right now happening all over the world, where we would get it in the paper 2 or 3 days later, with radio, it began to get a little bit better. But it seems to be that now children are exposed to things at a much younger age, and that's the reason their mental ability is increasing in leaps and bounds. Some of it I don't approve of, but you have to admit yourself the world's going a lot faster.
Yeah. What was there to do on the island's entertainment back in 1937?
Just fishing and swimming, and there was gambling, of course, but we didn't enter into that.
I've heard that it was a pretty swinging place in the early days.
The early days, they said that Port Aransas was a country unto itself. It didn't belong to the state of Texas or any place else. I guess maybe that's the way most of them felt, too. It wasn't open gambling in that sense of the word, like it is in Las Vegas and out in there. But there were games going on, and how tourists knew it or found it, I don't know, because I wouldn't know anything about it, but they would. And some of our tourist guests would come back 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and the next morning say, "I got taken," or something, and we'd know then that there had been a big game going on. And our little constable at that time had it rigged up some way so that when the rangers started over on the ferry, on the causeway, he knew about it and he could warn the gamblers, and the places would be closed up tight in the drum and everything peaceful and quiet when the rangers would get here. We've laughed about that too, because we didn't find that out until it was too late.
Well, I heard that there was a, shall we say, ladies of the evening in some of these gambling places or bars.
Well, now, I don't really know anything about that. I've never, as far as I know, there's been very little of that, if any, on the island. If so, it was very quietly done, because we never have actually been told that there were, or have any evidence that went on. But the gambling, yes, we do know that went on. But we've never had heard anything about any type of prostitution or anything like that. If it was, it was pretty well kept quiet, because we didn't hear about it. The main entertainment, of course, is the fishing. And when we first came, the tarpon fishing was the most important thing. And this was marvelous. They catch those huge silver kings, they were called. And I never will forget, first year we were here, Mr. Gibbs took me fishing with Florida Roberts, a famous guide here, who was quite a character in himself. He sang the bird on Nellie's hat was his entertainment for his fishing guests as he took you out. And he liked nothing better than to give a rookie, as he called him, a cane pole with a good strong line on it and put him out in to catch kingfish. And if you've ever caught a kingfish on a cane pole, this was terrible. No reel to reel it in, and those fish pull like everything, and they jerk and throw them around. And some of our people would come in and say they'd had more fun, but they'd be black and blue from falling all over the chairs and everything, getting those fish in on cane poles. But we went out one time with Florida, and about 3 days in a row for tarpon. And one of our friends was along with his wife, and she hooked a tarpon first day we went. In fact, she caught it. And she fought that fish for about an hour and a half, and with everybody telling her what to do. And when she got in, she was worn out, black and blue, from wrestling with that thing. So the next day when we went, every time that I would feel one nibbling, hitting my line, I just wouldn't make a move, but I didn't want to fight that big fish. And finally old Florida saw this, and he said, "Priscilla, the next one you get, you better hook, or else I'm going to throw you in." But luckily I didn't get another one, so I didn't have to fight the big tarpon. But it was quite a thrill to get them. We've seen some enormous fish brought in here. We saw a manta ray brought in. Oh, that was a huge thing, as big as this room, I guess, about 14 feet across. And then we've seen some massive jewfish, 600 and 800 pounds jewfish. And we've also seen sawfish, 14 feet sawfish. Used to come in here quite often, they bring them in. I don't know why they don't bring them in anymore. I guess they're not even fishing for them or even thinking about them. Mr. Gibbs has a lot of pictures of those. I'll have to show them to you sometime. And then the tarpon sort of dwindled, and they began going out farther and getting the tunas and the sailfish. So that seems to be for the real sport fishermen now, it's the sailfish and the tuna. They go out 14, 25, around in there, between 14 and 25 miles for those. But the ordinary fisherman still fishes for trout and redfish and kingfish and mackerel close around. Mm-hmm. We still have a lot of those fish. The piers have helped. We used to go out on the jetties to fish for mackerel, walk all the way out. And you catch many, you have quit to get them all in because they're too heavy to carry.
I'm saying there's been some fairly important people that have come down here to fish for tarpon. FDR, I understand.
Yes, I think he came in the winter of 1937 when I was in Oklahoma. And Mr. Gibbs got some pictures of him too. He fit, and he caught some nice tarpon too. There's a room down at the Tarpon Inn. Well, it's in the office, and the walls of the office are plastered, or let's see, papered, I guess would be the word, in these tarpon scales. And the names and the date and the size of the fish are all put on these, and they're stuck on the wall. And you must go. You'll see the famous people. I can't think of the name. Amy Semple McPherson. Who's the crusader now? Billy Graham. And Johnny, the football player from SMU. Johnny, you know.
I can't recall.
I can't think what his name is. Anyway, a lot of these interesting people come here, and some that we don't even hear about. By the way, Lady Bird Johnson was supposed to have been here during Easter weekend. The Secret Service was here expecting her, but I don't know whether she ever came through or not. She's one of the trustees of the university in Marine Lab out here and was quite interested in their new building program. That, by the way, is another interesting thing. She, when we first came, there was a pier out into the Gulf, here comes from, called the Government Pier. And it was a broken down thing owned by the government, and it was used to relay the rock that they brought out to build the jetties. This was where the barges would tie up, and then they'd take it on now. I think better cut it off. This dock was used, when we came, was just an empty dock. Nobody used it for much of anything. Fishermen would tie up to it to fish. I used it to go out and get shrimp. I walk out there and flag a shrimp boat coming in, and instead of having to pay for a dollar a pound for them, he'd take your bucket, and he'd come in off of the pullover, and he'd say, "What do you need?" "Well, some shrimp." Pick up your shovel and shovel a whole shovel full into your bucket, fill it up. "How much do I owe you?" "Oh, nothing, nothing, that's fine." You give him 50 cents and go on your way and have all the shrimp you could possibly use. Use the little bitty ones for bait and the big ones to eat. These days are long gone. Now this dock has been changed. The university owns it now, and it's been modernized and changed into a lab. And they've built a large building out there, that's classrooms and laboratories, and have bought the Enco Marina for their boat, and they have two or three boats. I don't know how many now. I guess three. And then they're now building more laboratory space and apartments and I guess some more classrooms. And closed our road to the beach. Yeah. We aren't happy about that, but they've rerouted it so we can still get through that way. This road we've been using all these years goes right down by the jetty. A lot of people like to fish from the jetty, and it's an easy access.
This new road isn't bad for getting down here either.
No, it's not bad. It's going to be all right. It'll add to it. It'll be all right when we get used to it. It's just people get in a rut.
Yeah.
Like when we first came here, this property had a little road going all the way across it, and it had worn down until it was a rather rutty road, and we fenced the property with a barbed wire fence in order to establish our lines, and the island people just had a fit. "You can't do that. That's a road. You can't close that road." Well, it wasn't a road, but this is the way people are. And now we've closed the alley into our property and are paying taxes on it, so it's now our property. But these things can be done legally. But it takes old-timers a long time to get used to that idea. I don't know much else about the jetty. The jetty was started in early 1920s, I guess, because I noticed the dates on some of the rocks over there, the cement, they've got the dates in them, and some of them go into 32, 35.
And you think that they started it in 29?
I don't know when they started. They must have started in the early 20s, because that channel had to be protected so that it wouldn't fill in like all the others had. You see, the channels that they used to take into Corpus have moved. Mr. Gibbs says they've moved from all the way down St. Joseph's Island to this pass. Mm-hmm. And this is the only one that they've really kept open. The old Mary was sunk.
And they kept this one open only because they put the rocks up there.
Yeah, that's right. And that's evidently the reason they're bulkheading this new one down on the out, about 10 miles, 12 miles down.
Yeah.
They're bulkheading that with rock, with granite too, so it's evidently they're planning on keeping it open.
And it must be, it's going to be a channel or the jetties like they are up here with the big old granite rock, mm-hmm. I suppose, so that's what I saw them carrying all this.
Yes, I did. And there's a lot of it down there.
Mm-hmm. And I had never gone down there to see it.
Well, you must go. It's pretty deep now, the channel is, and they're, as soon as that bridge is finished, they'll open it up all the way through. The surfers have been having contests down there because the surf breaks real good in front of those rocks where they've got them all stacked
up. Yeah, if they don't build a pier down there, then
surfers will have a beach of their own.
You mentioned riding out the hurricane, 42 was the worst one you had. How many of you ridden out, and what did you do to prepare? And
well, let's see, since we've been here, we had the 42 storm, which was a pretty bad storm.
Well, you don't think any of them were as bad as Syria, do you?
No, Syria was the worst one that we've had since we've been here, and it was as bad, from all statistics, it was as bad as the 1919 storm. But 42 storm, we had water and a good bit of wind, but there wasn't, I don't believe there was as much house damage as there was.
Well, of course there weren't as many houses, but I don't think there would have been that much, as much damage done had there been that many houses as was done in the city, because it just leveled the place off.
But the 42 storm was a long storm.
There must have been a lot of water, because they didn't, so many people had water in their houses that storm and then the next.
Well, Mr. Gibbs stayed in it, of course, he always does, and he said that the wind blew for 18 hours. And that's a long storm.
Yeah.
And he'd reach his hand over the edge of the bed and feel the water, so he didn't want any use getting up, so he's just going back to sleep again. So the water went down. And then the next bad storm was the 45 storm. And this storm, in the 42 storm, I took the bus and went to San Antonio. And the storm followed us up there. It was pretty bad up there. It blew things around up there, too. But in the 45 storm, I took the children in an old Cadillac that my brother had left down here when he went into the service, and I got as far as Beeville with it, and it broke down completely. And the Beeville people were all getting ready for the storm, too. So I walked around to a little old garage there, and the boys said, well, we'll come work on it in a little bit. And they did.
Well, we spent both those storms, 42 and 45, in Beeville, too. But the people who were lived at those houses by us we called it Beeville Street because they had their summer houses here, the Hall family, the Ramuses, and the Waltons. And they always, nearly every time they were here on the island when the storms were coming in, and they'd just tell us, come on up to our house, any place up there, and you're welcome to stay with us. And my mother always left with my brother and me. But Dad nearly always, well, Dad, I can't remember him ever going with us, so he stayed here during all of them. And in one storm, 42 or the 45, it must have been the 45, and he was running the ice plant, the power plant here on the island. And my Aunt Opal was the chief telephone operator. She always had to stay, man the telephones to the last minute, and then as soon as they'd go back in, then she could start getting calls out again. And sometimes she'd be the only person, the lines would be down here, but they could contact her at the telephone office and she could let them know who was still all right and which houses were gone and stuff. And this one time, they stayed. The water got up real high and it was coming up, and the men in the ice plant had gone over to the man who was head of all of it was Mr. Boone Walker. And the telephone office was in his house. And my aunt was there in his house, and he and his wife were here, plus the men who ran the power plant on the island. So the men in the power plant, including my father, went over to the Walker house and told him the water was coming up fast, and they'd better get over to the plant because they could stand on the tanks where they made the ice, and they could get higher up there away from the water. So they did, but from the time that my father and the others had left the power plant, the bores over a lime pit right in front of the power plant had floated away. The water came up and floated these things away. So all of these men, by that time the wind was blowing hard enough that they all had to hold on to each other. My aunt is only about 4 feet 10 inches tall and a little bitty skinny thing, weighs about 7 pounds. And she and Mrs. Walker were the two women, and they had an old calf with them. And they were all following, holding each other, and they went into the lime pit, all of them, one behind the other, and they climbed out the lion's head on the other end, and of course they were soaked. So They had to wear, the men who worked there always hung their dirty overalls, the coveralls that they used when they were working. They had them hanging on the wall, so that's what they wore through the rest of that night until they could get out of there. And my parents' home is on Real High Land, and it's never had water in it since we lived there. And so they went up there. And by the time they arrived at Mama and Dad's house, other people had already gone there for protection. And there are two funny things happened there. One of them was that my brother and I had made some little wooden birds and one of them was a red bird, and we had them sitting on the front on the fence outside. We nailed them into the fence. And this old boatman, Pat Thames, was sitting there. And he said, that poor little bird, he stayed there through the whole thing. He didn't know that they were wood. And another thing was, Mama had a canary, and right above the canary, the wallpaper on the ceiling was filling up with water. And it filled and filled until finally it burst over the top of the bird and soaked him real good and scared everybody when it went like that.
How many people were standing there?
I don't know how many people, probably around 20 or so had gone there. Just anybody. You know, because the island people who have houses up high, I have always told the others that those who stay go on up to our house if you have to. And so they do.
That must have been the 45 storm.
Must have been the 45.
Well, I took my children to Beagle, and we stayed there for 2 days. And when we came back from that one, I couldn't see no reason for staying here anymore. The roads were washed out. This road was washed out. All of them
were washed out. The ferry was gone too. I don't mean the ferry, but the ferry landings.
The ferry landings were gone. We had to come out from Aransas Pass all the way out on the ferry.